Yeah, as they say, a couple of issues back on Hilda Mary Woods, who I believe is going to star in tonight's. Yes, so welcome, Vern. Not farewell as yet.
Thank you very much for that, yes. Very original joke. There you go. Yes, I have a son who's just started teaching, and the first thing he has to figure out what to do is how to handle with the kids snickering over the name when we start. You know, that's really anyway, it's great to be here. Thank you all for coming out on this night. So as Ted said, a little bit of history. Science and people and the balance you can determine at the end. I'm giving the talk, but with a great deal of help from Tony Johnson, means basically this is all joint work, joint research that Tony and I have done. Over the past few years, and it's been great fun to do it with Tony. And he's volunteered to answer all the questions, as is the normal comment when you have something like that. So anyways, so a few things, we'll see what happens. I've got to try and press this at the right time and all that thing. But, so the origins of the Medical Research Council Biostatistics Unit go back to the early part of the last century, when we had a liberal government of ASQIF, who was introducing various social reforms, these being largely spearheaded by David Lloyd George, who was the Chancellor, and Winston Churchill, who was the President of the Board of Trade. In 1909, they had introduced the very famous People's Budget, which introduced taxes on the wealthy that would support, essentially, the creation of the social welfare programs that they wanted to do. And what we're particularly concerned with here is the National Insurance Act of 1911. This act was implemented by Sir Robert Morant, and the provisions were twofold. In part one, every worker who earned more than £160 per year had to pay insurance of 4 pence per week. To that 4 pence, the employer added 3 pence, and the state added 2 more pence. And so David Lloyd George basically sold this as saying you get 9 pence for 4 pence. The benefits from this insurance would be sick leave. So you would get 10 shillings a week for 13 weeks and then 5 shillings a week for the next 13 weeks. Free treatment for tuberculosis and eligibility for treatment by a panel doctor. And then the Act had very similar provisions for unemployment insurance, which was part two of the Act. But as one of the, one part of the Act also set up a medical research fund. And the medical research fund was basically 1 penny was contributed for each insured person in the UK. And then once you set up the fund, somebody has to manage it, and they set up the Medical Research Committee to, in 1913, to administer the fund. And essentially, that Medical Research Committee is the forerunner of the MRC. And so 1913 is essentially the start of the Medical Research Council, which is why they're celebrating their centenary this year. The first secretary, or the first head, of the Medical Research Committee was Sir Walter Fletcher. His scientific background was as a fellow of the Royal Society with work on biochemistry of muscle contraction. He was in post for 20 years. And he basically oversaw a great deal of the development of the Medical Research Council, and in particular took them through the transition in 1922 to the Medical Research Council by Royal Charter. And that was to guarantee independence from any government department, which, as the current director knows, is not quite so easy to implement now because their finances seem to come into play, and there are certain demands. But anyways, in principle, scientifically, the MRC is independent from the government, and that's a very important aspect of that original charter. And I think, actually, back, so this is November 1913, they set down a scheme of research for the Medical Research Council. And I think it's quite far-sighted, really, what they were doing back there. So there's a lot of interest in tuberculosis, and specific and industrial injuries, etc. But when they said, what type of research are they going to look at? It's just the extension of medical knowledge. You know, the actual field of research was not limited in any way of what we do. And then they set out, well, how are we going to actually do the research? What do we need if we're going to try and extend medical knowledge? Well, the first thing, they're going to have investigators who are in the permanent employ of the MRC, devoting full time, basically, to research. Then there will be people who will be providing the material that you need for the research, whether it's clinical or otherwise. They could be permanent or temporarily employed by the MRC. And then, thinking of a grant-type structure, they would also be individual investigators, wouldn't be employed by the scheme, but they would be given money for particular researchers that they might be doing. Now that seems pretty far-sighted, that's pretty good, but no, the really important thing is point four, because they said right back then they need a statistical department, which they described as mainly consisting of persons in the permanent employ of the scheme, and they said that these investigations would be useful either as preliminary to research or confirmatory of the results, so basically contributing across the spectrum of the research that would be done. So, they wanted to set up the statistical department, and we can now turn to who did they choose to run the department. And so we'll go to the first director, who is John Brownlee. And there's a noticeable absence of pictures of John Brownlee. I think this is the only one that we can come up with. So you'll see it a few times in the next couple slides. But there you go. So John Brownlee, very much a son of the manse. His father and brother were ordained, as was the brother and son of his mother, so he was very much tied up with the Kirk. But he took a different route. He studied mathematics, natural philosophy in Glasgow, and then he went on and did a medical degree, and an MB in 1894, and an MD in 1897, and that MD was on the topic of scarlatina, or scarlet fever. He has a connection with Cambridge. He at least sat the examinations for the Diploma of Public Health from Cambridge. He didn't actually have to be here except to write the exams, as we understand it. But he sat those exams. And in 1907, he was awarded a statistical, he was awarded a DSC for his statistical studies in immunity. His early career, after his MD, he was a resident physician in a fever hospital in Glasgow, the Belvedere. And then briefly, that was about 2 years, and then about a year, he went down for a year in Guernsey to become medical officer of health. But he returned quite shortly thereafter and became the physician superintendent at the Belvedere fever hospital and then at the Ruchill hospital.
Yep. There's a quick point of information. You have a fever hospital. Was there any particular fever that a fever hospital was likely to specialize in?
Infectious diseases generally, but there's a whole article. Can you answer that? Do you remember anything very specific?
Yes, I mean, fever hospitals were set up starting from about 1820 and then eventually came in by government statute from about 1860. So they were there specifically to deal with infectious diseases.
I think it's just infectious diseases is what I thought. I didn't know.
But that's right. Smallpox was put separately.
They wouldn't put smallpox cases in the fever hospital because they were worried about the
infection.
Yeah. They just happened in the
home. So his work there was quite, obviously quite influential and quite highly respected because there's still a Brownlee Centre for Infectious and Communicable Diseases in Glasgow over 100 years later. And in fact, it's why I learned today, it's one of the four laboratories in the UK on the WHO list of laboratories can perform the rapid diagnosis of H1N1 virus. So it's connected to something very modern. John Brownlee married in 1901 and had a daughter in 1902. But unfortunately, his wife died in early 1909 with Brownlee by her side. And therefore, throughout his career, he obviously was caring for his daughter. It's interesting that this is not basically not mentioned in any of the obituaries, and yet it must have had a fairly significant you know, influence on his life. So. I'll come on to his work in a minute to explain why he might have been appointed first director. But he was the first director of the MRC Statistical Department, and that was an appointment in 1914. Come back a little bit later, he was slightly eccentric in that it's claimed by in the history of the MRC that one of his administrative principals was never or hardly ever to reply to letters. We don't get many letters now, and if we substituted email, that's a very attractive policy, actually. But and he was the director from 1914 to 1927, when he died quite suddenly from bronchopneumonia. So what kind of work did he do? The majority of his work was on infectious diseases. Now, his initial papers, this is a very interesting development, because his initial reports were on outbreaks of disease, which he would have been taking, you know, he would have been observing it basically in the fever hospitals. But then suddenly there was a shift, to more general papers, such as the age distribution of acute infectious diseases. In this, he became to be regarded as a Carl Pearson's disciple, a Pearsonian disciple. It's unclear, but it seems unlikely that he actually ever attended lectures at UCL. But clearly, he was very attracted to Pearson's methods, and Pearson's methods were very prominent in his papers. He also published papers on in evolution and Mendelian genetics prior to 1914. And he's well known for having a very strongly held view that epidemics died out to a decline in the infectivity of an epidemic organism. And this was in contrast to Ronald Ross, who argued for the concept of susceptibles, and there was a scientific debate between them over that for a number of years. And obviously, Ronald Ross essentially was correct, so he won that one. But and sometimes this was portrayed as quite confrontational, but actually, both of them wrote fairly open-minded letters at the time. I mean, in hindsight, of course, Ross was right. But it maybe wasn't apparent at that time, and both of them reflected some uncertainty, although arguing their case strongly. So he started the MRC Statistical Department, and he was expecting great things from them. But of course, 1914 was the start of the war, so almost immediately it gets seconded for war work. And staff jumped up to 100, and then by 1919 it was up to 225, and a lot of their effort went towards compiling records of the sick and wounded from the war.
Where was it?
It was in Hampstead, North Hampstead. It's like I can't say any closer than that. Can you say exactly where?
Yes, it didn't. The MRC had bought as an institute.
There's an National Institute of Medical Research.
A redundant hospital up in Hampstead, which remained, in fact, the National Institute of Medical Research until 1948. Mm-hmm. And they was reverted to a hospital in the First World War, and had research as well.
Yeah. But so the interesting is I think it was Higgs, a medical historian, has written that you know the MRC was investing all this money in the statistical department. They didn't have much to show for it, and in a sense that was right. There wasn't a lot of medical research that came out of this. In fact, Brownlee wrote a paper in early 1900s and saying, as he was about to embark on this position in the war, saying, I'm going to write some of this down because I'm not sure I'm going to have any time to work on this over the next few years. And so in fact, there wasn't as much research maybe as you would have liked, but all these records they kept were used a great deal after the war to basically support the soldiers' claims for compensation. So I think those soldiers thought there was a great deal that came out of the statistical department, even though in researchers' terms it wasn't so much. So that's John Brownlee. Now he's, as I said, he was regarded as a little bit eccentric. And this is a little caricature of Brownlee sitting here, and he's explaining the play Hamlet to Dr. Chalmers, who was the Glasgow Medical Officer of Health at the time. This is some characters that a colleague, Dr. Mabar, who was a Scottish playwright as well, did of Brownlee. And I think it's that caricature, I'm sort of lecturing on it, seems characteristic of these quotes that we found. I would say likable, somewhat eccentric. says you, it should be say Ewell. Sorry, how many times do I have to read the slides of mine? Anyways, Ewell said he was an odd sort of fly, seemed to be nearly still and then suddenly flicking the blessed flies in another position. And then Greenwood, Major Greenwood, who had come to, succeeded him, said, well, if one were in a hurry to get from him specific information upon a matter of fact, say the method he fitted a curve, to find that after 10 minutes conversation one had learned a great deal about Highland place names, the organization of the Kirk in the 18th century, and the history of alchemy, but nothing at all about the curve was somewhat occasionally irritating. Might be irritating. Typical understatement. There you go. So, an interesting character who was the first director of the MRC. And as I said, people are interrupting, so that's good. So we're going to move on now and talk about Major Greenwood. Of course, Major is a proper name, not a rank. And he studied medicine because his family wanted him to study medicine, but he never really was taken by this. And he wanted to turn to research, which he got a position at the London Hospital in physiology, as a researcher in physiology, working with Leonard Hill, who was the head of the group at that time. And they actually did a lot of work together on the effect of rapid decompression on humans, and a number of series of papers along that type. And then the history of Major Greenwood, as it's recorded, is that he worked at the London Hospital up till 1910, which is how he described it, and he was appointed resident statistician at the Lister Institute in 1910, typically characterized as the first position of this type in the UK. So he obviously had a reputation at that time in statistics through some of his work. The latter parts of that work tended to see more statistics being done.
Any idea of how he acquired it?
Hold that for a minute. Then after the, well actually it's interesting too, let me go back for a minute, because the research post that he got at the London Hospital was actually an appointment with a neighbor. So Leonard Hill lived actually, the Hill and the Greenwood families lived close to each other in East London. And when he said, Leonard Hill said to his wife that he was going to appoint Greenwood, apparently his wife said, I do hope you're not going to appoint that cynical little man to your staff. To which Hill replied, the boy has brains. He'll never be any use as a doctor, and I must give him a chance in science. So there you go. But the appointment at Lister was a notable appointment, and therefore he came to people's notices. And in particular, he came to the notice of Sir Walter Fletcher, who you remember was directing the MRC at the time. And they developed really a quite close personal friendship, and Fletcher relied on Greenwood a great deal for statistical advice. And then in 1921, Fletcher wanted to set up this statistical committee. And after Greenwood's war work, because he had been seconded from a Lister for that, Fletcher had him appointed to the Ministry of Health and then seconded to the MRC, essentially. And he asked, after Pearson turned him down, Greenwood was asked by Fletcher to chair the MRC Statistical Committee. Now, there's a difference here between the Statistical Committee and the Statistical Department. And essentially, they both coexisted for the next 8 years or so. And you might think the Statistical Committee was a little bit higher level operations, or fairly some more senior people on that. But they basically existed. And in the history of the MRC, Greenwood is described as essentially working alongside Brownlee from 1921 to 1927. And he was the key that unlocked Brownlee's mind, which I think is a very interesting statement, that Greenwood was a good communicator. Brownlee had a lot of ideas, but wasn't always the best communicator. So I think that's a reflection on how he was performing. Now, as a little bit of advance notice and reward for coming out tonight, I shall put in another point here, which is something that Tony and I discovered recently as we were digging through the London Hospital archives, is that in actual fact, Greenwood was the first director of the physical department at the London Hospital in 1908. He still retained his appointment in physiology, but he was there. And I think that's, again, an indication of perhaps one of the ways he started to become noticed as a statistician. I'm not going to say any more about that. In fact, I'm saying somewhat less about Greenwood than I might have, because Tony and I are currently working on the paper, and so So, how was Greenwood doing? Well, giving a flavor for some things around the time, we uncovered in the London School of Hygiene archives a memorandum, or draft memorandum, actually, that Greenwood had written on the present position and prospects in medical statistics and epidemiology in 1928. And I've got the first paragraph, which I put up there. I think it is right that I should put on paper what I believe to be the realities of the position in which I find myself, and to do so not in the shape of a formal document to be submitted to some committee, but rather in as nearly an objective manner as it is possible for a man to adopt when writing about a subject which closely concerns himself. I think actually that paragraph is quite interesting in reflecting, saying something about Greenwood. He was very analytical about what he was doing. He saw himself as arguing, you know, the medical statistics case. And in doing so, in this particular memorandum, he dealt with three main topics: the profile of medical statistics in 1928, mathematical statistics in the UK, and the staffing of his department or unit. And I think probably, in reading the memorandum, it was the latter thing that prompted the writing in some sense, but the rest of it set the stage for that. And the profile of medical statistics, he pointed out that there was important work in medical statistics in both the Department of Health and the Medical Research Council, but there were relatively few people involved, and most were not medically trained, so that transition had been taking place. Then he talked about the mathematical statistics, and that reflected essentially a dominance of Carl Pearson. Greenwood himself had a very high regard for mathematicians. He has a lot of things in this memorandum about Isserlis, who's not that well known now, and he wanted to recruit him, which never seemed to happen. But of course, he did hire Irwin, who had been trained at UCL and at Rothamsted, and was probably the most noted theoretician in the medical statistics community during the early part of the last century. So he did get the mathematical strength into his department and eventually. Interestingly, there was no mention of Fisher, but there doesn't appear to be any antagonism. There's some records back and forth between them, which is quite cordial over Fisher's appointment to the Galton Chair, etc., but it's just interesting that it's not there. As I said, Greenwood published a lot in sort of substantive areas of disease and something on the ophthalmic index, which I won't say anything about. His most famous contribution, now what's Greenwood's most famous contribution? Say that again?
Curability of breast cancer.
Curability of breast cancer? I want another book. I want something.
Variance
of the
survival.
Variance of the survival estimate, yeah. Okay. So, and this he did in the appendix. By the way, just like to point out here, let me just go back. That's the most common type of picture of Greenwood. But this proves that he did smile. So there you go. He did that in a report on the natural duration of cancer. But that's where that result was in the appendix, and I'm sorry, I have a terrible slide of this, actually the result, and it's just a terrible copy. That's not possible. And I was going to transcribe it, but to be honest, I ran out of time. So there you go. He didn't see that. But that's probably the most famous technical thing that he's known for. He's not, but as I say, he was a great supporter of the importance of mathematics in medical statistics. And then, as I say, the last topic is the staffing. Interesting remarks. Essentially, I've just picked out three here. Greenwood and Woods are settled with, this is talking about finances and resources, that sort of thing. Russell is much better than I thought and will also rise. And A.B. Hill is on a regular scale and worth more. Well, Greenwood is a sort of self-reference. We've got a Woods, we've got a Russell, and we've got A.B. Hill, who is probably pretty well known. Bradford Hill. So that's some of the staffing, and we'll come back a little bit to that. But just as we sort of finish talking about Greenwood a little bit, I just point out that that in a way both Browning and Greenwood were champions of the Personian method. They were taking the methods. I think Pearson was slightly, not that highly regarded in the medical community. But these people championed his work. But Brownlee, as I said, was not terribly a great communicator. So to his medical historians, Hardy and Magnello wrote this. Unlike John Brownlee, his papers were so reliant on mathematical statistics that only those trained in the biometric school could read them. And Tony and I will attest to that since we just finished a commentary on one of his genetics papers. And it was a little bit difficult to figure out what was going on. The first page took ages, actually. I had to get some experts to come in and help me sort out what in the world was going on. But Greenwood took considerable pains to keep a significant proportion of his work in a language comprehensible to ordinary educated people. So he did have a particular impact in that way. And he's got also lots of more popular writings of people who are involved in medical statistics, etc. as well. So Major Greenwood, now I'm now going to move on to Austin Bradford Hill. Now most of you will probably be quite familiar with his career, but essentially he wanted to study medicine, unlike Greenwood, I guess, who didn't want to and did. But Austin Bradford Hill wanted to and didn't because of World War I. Now he was invalided, though, out of the Army in 1919, and that allowed him to take a correspondence degree in economics. And after that, somehow, he decided he wanted to get into medical research. Obviously, he had this interest in medicine. And Greenwood helped him to get some MRC funding to examine high mortality in young adults in rural areas. Now, this is interesting, of course, because here is Greenwood returning the favor, because Leonard Hill, who hired Greenwood, was Bradford Hill's father. So the families remain connected through this. So his career was essentially kickstarted by Greenwood. Austin Bradford Hill, as did Greenwood, attended Carl Pearson's lectures at UCL, and jumping way ahead, he actually was the next director of the unit, succeeding Greenwood in 1945 at the end of World War II, when the name was changed to the Statistical Research Unit shortly after he took over there. So what's the most famous contribution of Hill? What about smoking and lung cancer? Okay, that's one.
The criteria.
Criteria for causation is two.
Medical statistics.
What? Randomized trials, yeah. Principles of medical statistics, yeah. Okay, so the three and four, anyway, somewhere up there is certainly his book on principles of medical statistics. So this was basically, this was a book, of course, as you probably know, based on a series of Lancet articles written and published, actually, between January and April 1937. Went to 12 editions, this book, that's one of the reasons it's famous. And I think actually as far as the written work, I think it's probably, along with the criteria for causation and epidemiology, probably the most famous written work as far as the actual work is the clinical trials and smoking and lung cancer. So his contribution was there. So what I'm going to do now is just make a few remarks about this book, how it came about. So the beginnings of the principles of medical statistics. So he's obviously had an invitation to write a series of articles for The Lancet. And in 1936, he himself says that he made only a half-serious request to consider publication of the articles as a book. However, things moved on. He was encouraged by the editor of The Lancet, Sir Squire Brigg, who said, publishers would probably take the book at once, and he would tell them that the subject of one particularly requires some fundamental elucidation. But the Lancet directors, financial overseers, were very apprehensive about this small book, production success of a small book at a low selling price. Which is interesting, actually. because he obviously wanted it to be accessible. And it is actually a tremendously important factor in the books. The sale of books is what they're priced at. So even back then, that was very important. So that was in February 1937. Hill's response to this hesitation, I just like to know as soon as possible what you're going to do. I understand from my correspondence that it was the intention to do a book, and I took a great deal of trouble with the articles with that in view. Putting in a number of people, stressed in the hope that the articles would be put into a book. And if you don't think that success is too, if you think the success is too speculative, I would wish to approach another publisher. So a little bit of pressure put on in that way. And they sort of relented by the 5th of April with reservations, like improbable that financial success would be achieved, and preferred that a period of time would elapse before even the cost of production could be recovered. Besides, we have to spend money on publicity. He had a little bit of back and forth negotiations about that, and they could eventually, however, terms were agreed on the 26th of April, 1937, and then they went ahead. A couple comments of correspondence at that time. Raymond Pearl, a very famous biometrician from the United States, who was a real advocate with Greenwood, actually, of medical statistics at the time, said, in my opinion, they are quite needlessly worried about the extent of the sale. The presentation is excellent. I'm sure the book will have a steady sale for a long time. And Fisher, I'm very glad to hear about your book, and probably others like it, are certainly much needed. So, having decided, Lancet went in behind it, so they have a preface from the Lancet editor. Reasonably, there's steadily increasing demand to both clinical and public health workers for some knowledge of that, statistical technique. So they came behind this effort, wrote the preface and selling it, and they also wrote an editorial. There's an editorial in the journal that was published as well. Hill himself, in the preface, describes why he wrote the book, essentially. The worker medical problem, field clinical as well as for medicine, must know something of the statistical technique, both in experimental arrangements and the interpretation of figures. To enable him to acquire some knowledge, I try to sit down as simply as possible. His methods and experience have shown me to be the most helpful in problems in which the medical workers are concerned. His examples taken from medical inquiries and attempt to make clear methods of analysis and sought to show by illustration where and why workers make mistakes in their interpretation of figures. This is very much a book directed at the practitioner. Okay? And people can read this and start to apply it to their work right away. And in many ways, that's why the book was as successful as it was. But what I want to now reflect on, so that's the book, and most people know a fair bit about the book, and I'll come back to what was in it in a few more moments. But what was going on in the background? What brought Hill to the point of writing the book? And of course, there was a number of things that were going on. Most of the books that would have been called medical statistics up until the early part of the last century were really books on vital statistics. But that's coming out. There was starting to be this growing development of the field of medical statistics, mentioned Pearl in the U.S. and others. But in the unit, in Greenwood's department, there was also some other things going on in the background. And here is the person that Ted mentioned, Hilda Mary Woods. And as he said, Tony and I and third author, who turns out to won't immediately recognize this, but is the niece and adopted daughter of Hilda Mary Woods. We have this article in Series A, and much of what I say in the next little while is taken from that article. So why are we talking about Hilda Mary Woods? Well, because I'll tell you later. First of all, I'm going to talk about Hilda Mary Woods. She was born in 1892. She was the eldest daughter in a family of five surviving children. And this is a picture, and that's... She started her, eventually she was educated in a boarding school, but she was older than her brothers, and when her brothers became old enough to attend, there wasn't enough money to go around, so there you go, that's the end of her education. And so she moved, though, creatively to something called Ellicott College in Richmond, where she took a position as a pupil teacher, so that she received education and boarding in exchange for her services. And there, she took the senior Cambridge certificate. I guess some of you will know better than I about this, but Cambridge local exams started in 1858 or so, and then they had a senior and a junior one, which eventually became a school certificate and a higher school certificate, etc. So in the senior certificate, she studied arithmetic, religious knowledge, English, drawing, and music, and she also received the licentiate of the Royal Academy of Music in piano with the violin as her second instrument. And you can see there, look at that, that's the obvious training for a statistician, right? Exactly what you need if you want to be a statistician. Well, maybe not. So how in the world did she become a statistician? So now we have some. Actually, I'll tell you. She actually wrote about how she became a statistician. There's an article, a little note that Rosemary Gere, her daughter, niece daughter, shared with us, and which is in the paper. I'll read the first part. "How dull," says the man in the street. "Can't think of anything more boring than columns and figures. Anyone can prove anything by figures. Only dry old professors and such ever become I can't pronounce it or spell it either. Even the man in the street, though, is sometimes wrong. I'm nearly 40, she says. Supposed to be quite good looking, and my dressmaker seems to enjoy making me clothes because Madame carries them well. I began work on statistics when I was a flapper." An avant-garde female of the early part of the century. So that's how she started her thing, and that's that. So I'm the point. So what happened? So on June 19th, 16, she wandered along Whitehall in search of work. Her fiancé had been wounded and was missing, and now reported killed. The world seemed very black and the future blotted out. Work was plentiful enough during those years of war, and I was willing to accept anything. The Admiralty wanted any number of girl clerks, starting at 25 shillings a week. The Home Office and India Office all offered much the same pay, but she noted that the India Office, you had to pass an entrance exam to be allowed to clerk there. But finally, she came to a door in Whitehall, marked administrative admissions, and underneath, the mysterious word establishments. Porter directed me along endless passage. There was a tap-tap of typewriters everywhere. Girls armed with files were hurrying to and fro, and it seemed like the hub of war activities in Whitehall. Well, is she going to get a job there? Is she qualified? You said she's had a little trouble with statistics earlier, you said. Oh, I see you have a senior Cambridge certificate. Are you any good at mathematics? There's a doctor in the welfare section who wants an educated person to travel around and get statistics from factories. You look too young, though. What age are you? I promptly added 3 years to my age and hoped silently I was educated, but doubted. However, an appointment was made with the doctor for the following Monday. The discussion goes on for a while. Well, I am afraid, continued my prospective chief with the father of the heir, you seem to be too young to travel about England. You would have to find your own lodgings and generally fend for yourself. I think you must discuss these questions with your parents before I can offer you the job. If they raise no objection, then you can begin work next week.
She's 24 at this point, right?
That sounds about right. The idea of travel appealed to me greatly, and it was no use consulting my parents because the answer would most certainly have been in the negative. As she says, fortunately for me, I never asked them. Although looking back, she says, I realized I was most ignorant of the ways of the world. Referring to Rosemary Gere, my niece of 14 is more sophisticated than I was in those days. Greenwood took her on, sent her out to the faculty. You can read more about it in the paper. So that was 1916. And then after the war, Greenwood returned to the Lister very briefly and took Noblewoods with him. But very soon thereafter, he resigned to move to the newly created Ministry of Health, the appointment that Fletcher had arranged for him there. Interestingly, Woods also resigned and moved with him then. And then he was seconded to the MRC's National Institute of Medical Research, and Woods was seconded along with him. During this time, she had about 4 publications, and also essentially acted as administrative assistant for the activities that were going on in the institute with Greenwood. And just prior to the move to the School of Hygiene, which took place in 1927, so this is, you know, seven years later, Greenwood wrote a note to Hilda saying, in the light of other things that he was writing about, "It is important in your interests as well as mine that you should be the only commissioned member of the ministry staff to accompany me to the school." That's for the School of Hygiene. So obviously they worked very closely together, and Greenwood was relying a great deal on Hilda Woods. So I'll skip all details now. We move on now to the School of Hygiene period, where Hilda Woods was the first female lecturer. Now you can understand, you can probably guess that she probably had a few incidents that happened. And this is some recollections which her niece remembers her saying. So when the division moved to Kettle Street, she went on the first day of the staff common room for tea, confronted at the door by a male lecturer, and informed her that her room was down the hall. Not where she should be. Well, down the hall was, of course, where the female secretaries and clerks were, and at least he was horrified when he was informed he had made a mistake. But the administration aspect still continued as well, and I think this is a very telling quote we found in the note from Greenwood, written in 1931. "I shall be glad that during my absence," says obviously Hilda, "you will deal with the administrative and official matters that I normally deal with as head of the division." So obviously had complete confidence in her as an administrator there. So this is a picture of Hilda Woods and Greenwood in a family sort of shot. We don't know who the other people are. I'm going to go on and talk a little bit more about what she did, but just to fill you in on the highlights of what happened. So she worked with Greenwood until 1933, so just 2 years after that quote was written, and left in 1933 to marry and move abroad, and she was going to marry Roger Falk. Unfortunately, they left, and her husband died in 1934 in Ceylon, just a few months after they were married. So a second tragedy in their life, really, the fiancé and then the husband dying. Basically died from a tube abscess, which led to septicemia. I would have thought that, given that you'd often come back to the UK. But no, she stayed in Ceylon and threw herself into social services in Ceylon, working on factory conditions, malaria, disease prevalence studies. And only 2 years later, in 1936, she was awarded an MBE for social services in Ceylon. And then shortly after that, she did have to return to England because of ill health and was not able then to return to Ceylon. In World War II, she did return and do some additional statistical work on nutrition. And it is interesting, the one study that we have a publication on reads, it was a study of girls at orphanages assigned at random to either fortified or unfortified chocolate, reading nutrition. The trouble is we can't actually determine what that at random means, but it's tantalizing, isn't it, that it was, you know, randomized study. But it's definitely in the publication, so there was something that went on. And in this time, she also had some collaborations with Greenwood on statistical aspects of what she was doing. But then, later in the 1940s, her brother was out in Kenya with his wife, who probably was not coping all that well. He wanted, her brother asked her to come out and help him, and she agreed to do that. And then his brother's wife died in childbirth in 1947. And at that point, Hilda dedicated herself to being a mother to her niece. And that essentially dominated her life for the rest. When her niece was 11, her brother died as well. So she was a single parent from there on in as well. She subsequently returned to England. She was very active in all sorts of organizations, which you can read about. And then eventually moved with her niece to South Africa in 1970 when her niece got a job down there. And in 1971 she died. And it was interesting, she died a week before her adopted daughter married the son of one of her students from the School of Hygiene many years earlier. So connections are quite amazing. It is an amazing life. There's a little more in our article. But I now want to go back to... that's a picture of Hilda Woods in the 1950s. So that was probably a time when she was very active in volunteer organizations in the UK. She was a great organizer, apparently. She was always organizing things.
That's not Bradford Silver's hand, do we see that?
Anyways, actually, in some sense, the way that Tony and I got started into all this stuff is this book, An Introduction to Medical Statistics by Tony Woods and William T. Russell. This was a book, obviously, Introduction to Medical Statistics, published in 1931. The second edition was published in 1936. Now, the second edition isn't much changed, but obviously it was essentially reprinted in 1936, so still being used at that time. I'm not going to say much about William Russell. He was Irish, born in Killarney, educated in Dublin. He joined the MRC in 1915, again, I don't think with any particular statistical training, worked with Brownlee first, and then Greenwood, and then in 1943 he moved to Oxford to the Institute of Social Medicine. We have not really been able to find out very much about him outside of that sort of bare bones knowledge. We did have I should put this up earlier. Anyways, we did have a little look at this book in more detail in the paper of Statistics and Medicine in 2010, and some of what I'm going to say is basically going to come from that as well. So, what about these two books? I mean, so we have Bradford Hill publishing a book in 1937 from the School of Hygiene, whereas this previous book was published in 1931-36, both basically on medical statistics. How similar were they? Well, I've got Hill's chapter titles down the right side, and we can just sort of see how they overlap with the titles in Woods and Russell. Presentation of statistics in Hill. We have tabulation of data and construction of charts and graphs in Woods and Russell. Variability, averaging standard deviation, averages and measure of dispersion. So we can match up of those. Regression, the coefficient of correlation, calculation of correlation coefficient in Hill. Interestingly, the chapter title does have regression in Woods and Russell, but essentially the same sort of material, correlation and coefficient of regression. Life tables and survival, life tables, so that topic was in there. And sampling. Now sampling at that time was essentially statistical inference. What was the distribution of the numbers that you were calculating? And Hill obviously had a great deal on that, and Woods and Russell had a single chapter. That's an interesting one. Sampling, as I say, essentially statistical inference. But Woods and Russell really discuss this in quite a light manner. So talking about a significance test, they point out a small significance level still represents a choice between two alternatives. Rare events do occur. No hypothesis could be true, but rare events. And then also, any choice of a cutoff determines significance is arbitrary. So very interesting. And in contrast, as far as we can see, consistently Hill writes just of yes-no decisions with respect to significance in this book. So that was an interesting distinction. And then you go on. These are the chapter titles that sort of don't overlap in the books. And I think, looking at that, says something about the two books as well, because Wood and Russell have covered sort of all the technical topics. And as I say, it has some excellent discussion in it, but it has a little more of the feel of a handbook. But obviously, it's not a handbook on vital statistics. Right? They do have to talk about vital statistics, which Hill does not do, and very explicitly does not do, although he does introduce, come back to that topic in his later editions. So they're linked. They're coming out of this vital statistics world, if you like, the books. That's not what they are. They are statistics. And it's fair to say that the book, which is of this size, looks a little bit like a handbook. Some of the examples do overlap, by the way, between the two books, typically treated a little differently. It's a little bit more of a handbook, but if you look over there, the aim of the statistical method is a broader title of the first chapter. I think the chi-square is irrelevant. The common fallacies and difficulties. That was, remember, when Bradford Hill was saying he was going to show where the common mistakes were. And I think that probably reflects why Bradford Hill's book became quite the dominant influence, because it spoke more directly into the broad nature of medical research. But the reviews of Woods and Russell were very positive by Ewell and others. One very negative review, which was peculiar, I think, and we thought when we looked at the comments made. But still very positive, and even reviewed positively, I can't remember the details now, there was a review of Bradford Hill, one of his later editions, at the same time as Woods and Russell was still around, and then again they did another review of that, which was still very positive. So interesting, these two books. Now Hill did acknowledge what was going on there. So in the first edition, there is an acknowledgement to Russell in the preface as a colleague, and there's a full reference to Woods and Russell in the text. And then that's on page 118, and an abbreviated reference on page 147. By and large, the references disappear, because those are typically linked to the vital statistics chapters that Hill didn't have in his first edition. And this book then, I think, essentially gradually dropped out of view for many years. And I think I'm just going to close now just in this topic and say this was the appraisal that Tony and I came to after trying to look in somewhat more detail at the content of the chapters I've just given you the titles tonight. In contrast to Hill's Principles of Medical Statistics, Woods and Russell's introduction is comparatively unknown. However, it's no disservice to Hill to bring this lesser-known volume out of obscurity. It deserves to be recognized as reflecting an important stage in the transition from vital statistics to medical statistics. Indeed, while it's limited in its content, it can be regarded as the forefront of texts on medical statistics as the subject is now understood. And given the background of the two authors, this is a particularly considerable achievement. Their ability to move from relatively routine vital statistics to broader interest was fostered in the environment of the School of Hygiene and manned by Greenwood's leadership of the work there. You can see from various things that Greenwood really did foster his staff, did move them along in their careers. But as in all situations, the individuals involved had to take advantage of the opportunity, and their work is a testament to their willingness to take on what must have been a particular challenge. So, there you go. A little bit of an overview of what happened early on in the MRC Biostatistics Unit. It's very important to look forward, but as you get old and decrepit and can't keep up with the young minds doing these fancy things, you start doing history, and so that's why you got history from me tonight. But I think it actually is important sometimes to look back and to see where we've come from and on whose shoulders we're building. And of course, I think one of the things we say about Hilda Mary Woods is Greenwood is sort of the giants, and they say he's standing on the shoulders of giants, but they're also the contributors back then who are still playing an important role in the subject as we know it today. So hopefully this will give you a little flavor for what's happened in the past and have some questions which Tony's going to answer. Or other people.
Right. Anybody?
Could I kick off what work was Woods doing in the Ministry of Munitions during the First World War? And the reason for asking that is that the Minister of Munitions at that time was a man called Edison, who had been on the original MRC, because his background was Dean of St. Bartholomew's Hospital. And he had then gone to work with, in Parliament, worked closely with Lloyd George, succeeded Lloyd George as Minister of Munitions, and it was he who studied the effects of, or he was concerned about the effect of alcoholism in munitions workers, the amount of absenteeism.
Yeah.
Now, was she
essentially she was doing that sort of thing.
Well,
she, job was to go out into the factory. The job she was hired for was to go out into the factories and collect statistics related to absenteeism and diseases, etc., in the factories.
Okay.
And so that was what she was hired for. And then, of course, she moved on from that to actually preparing reports of this and started doing the graphs and figures, etc. Actually, it's very interesting in the paper, too. She obviously was, she went out to the first factory and looked around and decided she couldn't count, she couldn't get the statistics. There was no quality here. And she was really worried about this and went back to Greenwood. And she was sort of in trepidation. And he said, well, no, in that case, you can't do it. And therefore, you know, just send them up. So, but that was what they were working on. And obviously, other places, they did get statistics. That was the focus. So I didn't know about Edison, so that's very interesting.
Edison then introduced restricted hours for pubs, which have disappeared recently. But that was where the licensing hours for selling alcohol came in.
Okay,
in
well, I just didn't know that. We have to put that one down.
So I'm just sort of asking whether that was what she was doing.
No, she was. She, that is definitely where she started.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're very curious. Early stage, or what you call middle stage, or whatever, like say covering tier 70 or something, I don't know, you call it recent or whatever, in some time, we're interested in that.
Oh, sorry, for the unit?
Yeah.
Sorry, is that what you're saying?
Early stage, I'm just saying who were a bit more recent than we're interested in that.
Yeah, but it's very late, you know, so. but yes, I mean, I think everything that's happened, you know, there's an awful lot that's built upon this part. I mean, even in the Second World War, there's still relatively few people working in the field. Obviously, there's an explosion now, but you know, you go back through the Hill and Richard Dahl studies on smoking and lung cancer. Richard Dahl was the director after Bradford Hill, and so he's contributed in Ian Sutherland and Nick Day. So yeah, no, there's lots of things that went on over that period, which deserve to be looked at.
What was roughly the
size? This is hard work, by the way. Passing comment, sorry, Sylvia. Passing comment. You know, when you get these technical papers back, and the referees come back and say, "Okay, what about this?" Right? I mean, so you work through that. When they say, "What about this?" in a historical paper, it takes forever to resolve the comment. Sorry.
I was wondering what was the.
I don't actually have those numbers. Actually, that maybe I didn't make. I probably didn't make it entirely clear because I didn't make it clear because I didn't say it. The statistical department grew during the First World War, and that obviously did shrink eventually after that. And by 1928, when Brownlee died, we had the statistical department, but Greenwood had moved on to the School of Hygiene, taking Woods with him. At that point, Fletcher decided that he would just essentially move the statistical department to the School of Hygiene under Greenwood.
Right, so
and then I think it would be a contraction then. And actually, I have no idea what the staff would have been. In fact, from what I was reading, I think it was probably sometimes hard to disentangle who was doing what
was
over the early years of the School of Hygiene, that time of the School of Hygiene. I think later on it was maybe there was a more of a distinction. But the numbers, I don't know. Sorry.
And it's about half with two when the door went to Oxford.
Oh, yeah. It was more than half.
Yes, you did.
We should talk about most of the year as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then it starts to get from there.
But Hill had effectively an academic department and an MRC.
Yeah, exactly. That's
yes.
So the staffing.
But I think Green would have the same issue essentially. Yeah. Once the MRC statistical department moved there, he also had, I think, the two operations going on.
And Richard Dole took the unit.
Exactly.
Away from the department.
Richard Dole was back to a unit director essentially. And then Nick Day, when he was here, had a university department. And Ian Sutherland is just the as a sign. Any other comments?
A bit of a tangential question. What do you think of the way statistics was developing around the turn of the century, late 1930s? One does not think of it as it were, growing out of medical applications. It sort of came from other directions.
Yes. Yeah.
And I really don't know, that's just why I'm asking, were the medical people saying, becoming aware of it and saying, we need this and we need to get to grips with it? Or was there some other input? And I think, for example, of Florence Nightingale. You know, she has made a mark, statistically speaking, in terms of casualties and illness and what have you, Crimean War. And that would have been very well known, but probably not heavily developed in a technical sense.
Well,
but then when Christian Fisher and others came in from other directions, perhaps the medics were saying, oh right, we can put it all together. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think not so much about the presentation, because it was David's published by others. Florence Nightingale had a career, very creative ideas on how to present numbers as well. But I think if you start speaking about inference and about sort of what we think of as inference, I think you're right. Certainly medical statistics didn't, medical applications didn't drive the development of statistics. So David Cox has written about this. You had your sort of agricultural era, Rothamsted and such like. That for a while was the dominant source of applications which drove the methodological development. Then it became industry, sort of through the 40s, 50s, sort of transition there, and then into medicine. I think what was happening in medicine at the first part of the century is that you had people like Brownlee and Greenwood, and as he said in his memo, there's not that many people around, but they were taking the methods that were being developed and seeing how they could be applied. So these papers that Brownlee did on genetics was all about how to measure correlation, which would say something about the remote inheritance. But he could see how to apply them. But they weren't particularly driving the methodology. I think that's absolutely right.
So they became aware of them through contact with Pearson, perhaps?
Well, no, Pearson is a really influential character in the sense that he trained, or people read his work, those people who started sort of the development of modern medical statistics. So Greenwood and Hill both took courses from him. As I said, Brownlee clearly read his material quite carefully and wanted to apply it. So I think it's that sort of direction that comes in. And they basically convinced the medical people that, yeah, they need this. This is offering them something.
Thank you. Then I just have a comment there.
Yeah.
Because Pearson was pushing his methodological statistics. There was fearsome resistance from the medical profession. They were virtually at war with each other. And you can see this in exchanges and correspondence in the BMJ. Almroth Wright versus Pearson. And I think Pearson was probably quite glad to have Greenwood on his side because he was medically qualified. And so helped to justify what Pearson was advocating.
Sorry.
I had to raise a wry smile when he showed Brad Pittell's preface to his book. And I just made a note to myself here. So it's true today in industry. I don't work in the medical statistics field. I work predominantly with engineers and back office support. And I'm still appalled with the lack of knowledge of statistical thinking in UK industry and organisations today. I mean, it is appalling. And I could just take that quote from his preface, and I could use that and apply it.
It's slightly worrying, actually. One of the themes of our memorandum, actually, even in medical statistics, was the same issues he was talking about then are applied now. When you say industry, I remember I worked for the telephone company for a short while and did a special project on regression and supply and demand, etc. I was working with this engineer, and I kept trying to explain what regression was. But he had the final line on the report, and so regression means going backwards. So that's why I'm a researcher, not a teacher.
And forecasting means going backwards.
That's why it's a cold regression.
It wasn't quite what I wanted to get across from it. Did you have a question?
Slightly embarrassed to ask this, but it does show my ignorance a lot. You talk about the transition from vital statistics to medical statistics. What does that mean? Vital statistics are just figures of
population, health, disease rates, and that sort of thing. Standard mortality ratios, that sort of thing. Right. That was the dominant sort of technique. So if you saw a book on medical statistics written before 1900, it typically was dominated by that sort of presentation. And so what I'm talking about medical statistics there is in the modern sense of a subject that has applicability across the medical fields, experiments and observational studies and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's important to realize that there was a transition that took place. It's when do you go back, right? I mean, Claude Bernard, had a lot of influence about actually the idea of experiment in medicine. That fed into things, and so on and so on. Anyways. Good. One more.
I was asking, when did the word biostatistics start to be used?
We have a little bit of comment on that. Biostatistics is more commonly used in North America. Biometrics was used for a long time. I think I'm going to say pass. It would have come in, obviously, in the 50s it was in use. I'd have to guess. Over supper, we were discussing the origin of words. I realize I don't know very much about it. It is interesting, that transition, because obviously when I was starting out, biostatistics was dominant in North America, and medical statistics was the root of it. But we're now in a biostatistics unit here, so there you go.
Any more?
Good.
Well, I think we can show appreciation not just for Vern for a lovely talk, but also for Tony Dobson, yes, please.
Indeed.
And they're truly a team, and we owe tonight to both of them, so thank you very much.